focus on not discovering the new physics, but interpreting it. So we'll assume that LHC reports a nice new signal, and I'm confident the experimenters and the standard model theorists will get that right, and they don't need my help to do that. So let's work on interpreting it. What is that new TEV scale physics? There'll be some overlap with, especially the first half of my talk, with things that will be in Joe Licken's talk at the end of the meeting too. So one of the questions is it really supersymmetry that we're seeing? And you can, I'll show you my bias more, but you know it already. I've been looking at that for a while. I think that's pretty easy. People have talked about confusions with other things, and the spectra can be mimicked, but I think when you look at everything, that's not so much of a problem. Then you start to ask which are the super partners produced, and you want to get a number of them listed. That's harder, and to relate it to the parameters of the soft breaking Lagrangian is very hard. You have to diagonalize matrices and things, and to the full electroweak effective theory Lagrangian is very hard. And then what we really want is to go toward unification scales and look for underlying theories. This whole series of things we've been referring to for some years is LHC inverse problems. So assuming it really is supersymmetry, the new information will mainly be about supersymmetry breaking. And of course, all of these things are important to do, although I'm going to focus on the underlying theory issue. Just to be totally clear, the underlying philosophy of what I'm talking about, which will show up in many ways in what I say, is that all the clues we have today are certainly consistent with there being an underlying theory at a high scale and one that's perturbative to that scale, and that's the kind of framework that I hope we're going to find and that I will assume could exist, and that we're looking for interpreting data in that framework. Most of the questions can be addressed in one theory that way, the important questions that we want to talk about, and I would encourage us to assume that's the way things are until we're forced to give it up. So the outline of the talk is, first I'll discuss a little bit running up information that we find at the low scale to the high scale. Then I'll talk about confirming that it's indeed supersymmetry, particularly by measuring the gluino spin early. Then I'll talk a little bit about testing things like Yagino mass unification that are one of the basic questions that we want to know about because it probes theories very much. And then I'll spend almost half the talk on an approach, mainly top-down, toward becoming systematic in getting information about high-scale theories and favoring some and excluding others. So several of these things could be separate talks all by themselves, and I think it's better in a context like this to give you a variety of things with a little bit on each. There are papers already to look at for some of them, and the paper on this one is in preparation, and they form a kind of unified way of probing things that I will present in too little detail, but that's probably okay. There's of course been a lot of study already, or some study of electroweak scale inverse problem, but very little study of the obstacles to extrapolating up. We have one paper a year and a half ago on some of the obstacles, which I'll spend a few minutes on, and Martin talked about another analysis yesterday, and there isn't much more that I know of on the obstacles to extrapolating up after we get some information at the low scale. In this paper that we wrote, we looked at several things, the effects of intermediate scale matter and how they could, of course, distort the procedure. And we looked a lot at what is the familiar to some S term. That's a term that's the hypercharge weighted sum of scalar masses, and it can shift things a lot. So here's a slightly dizzy graph. What's plotted here is the scale from electroweak up to some high scale, and here are the masses of scalars, and you imagine measuring them here and running them up. And this is a case where M squared HD is somehow done wrong at the low scale. Maybe it has big errors or it's very different. So the dashed lines, if you first look at them, are the way you would run up the right and left-handed sleptons and M squared HU, and they would unify at a high scale in the theory, and this is one of the SPS points that we used for that. But if you get M squared HD wrong, then you can see that they start to diverge because the running of the scalar masses has, if there's a non-zero S term, gets a contribution from that. And you can be completely wrong, they no longer unify at the high scale and so forth. If you form the appropriate linear combinations, in this case hypercharge weighted mass squares of the scalars, then all the things that give problems cancel out and you would get the right answer no matter what. So this is the kind of solution you can find to these kinds of problems. And in general, the obstacles are ones that can be studied by people but have not yet been studied nearly sufficiently, and one can find ways to avoid possible problems and learn how to go from low-scale data to learning things about high-scale data. There's no question there's a lot more work that can be done in this area that would be very important to do. Well, in the paper we write it in detail, but it's a hypercharge weighted mass difference of squares of scalar masses, and then S will cancel out in the right way to let you run that. But we go into detail in the paper with several examples of this. It's different from the things you found yesterday. It's not the same. This is a different issue than what you were looking at, but similar kinds of things were ones we found in our paper a year or some ago. I didn't want to take time to go into detail here because I want to go into other topics, so look it up. But it's in the paper, we have a list of the things to run. Yeah. I was just writing an example type equation. Yeah. Now I want to turn to a different subject, the question of an early measurement of the Guino spin. This is a more recent paper about 3-4 weeks ago. So suppose that a good signal is found with several inverse picobarn cross-section at the LHC. So it could be a Guino, or some of you will want to interpret it in terms of some of this kind of stuff. And what we want to do to find out what's going on is measure the spin. If we can show that there's a spin a half particle associated with that signal, then we've got good evidence that we're really seeing supersymmetry. In particular, most of the alternative approaches have integer spins. One can be, I'll show you something slightly more precise than these statements in a minute. And suppose that you make some measure of its mass in the simplest case, then there's a unique prediction of the production cross-section. You can do that, for example, for the top quark. Here's the mass of the top quark candidate, here's the cross-section. If it's got spin a half, then this dashed line gives the cross-section of the top quark, and if it's got spin zero, spin is quantized, so there's a huge difference. There's a factor of about 8 between these, and so you need only factor of 1.5 or 2 measurements of cross-sections to be able to distinguish in early data about something like this. And indeed, the spin of the top quark is determined to be a half by this, though for some reason that's often not listed in measurements of properties of the top quark. So we'll assume that the LHC, that one is looking at a large signal, that the production is QCD based, and so you can calculate it, and it's not got hardly any model dependence. And in general, it's a standard model kind of signal. So you can then look at cross-section versus the mass of the thing that you're looking at there, and that might be a gluino and might not, and the differences in size, note this is a log scale, are substantial, and so a measurement at the factor of 1.5 level of that is sufficient to give you an early determination of the spin. Just a minute. So I comment on that here. But the answer is initially that you should assume a hypothesis like, is it a color octet gluino that you're finding, and you test ideas in physics by making a hypothesis, seeing if they come out right. Then after you've got better data, maybe a little better data, you can start trying different colors. You can try lots of things and check them. You'll have some of the small variations in the cross-section depend on gauge couplings. You can add that in. But of course, if you want to get an early determination which distinguishes different theories, this will work in most worlds. That is, it's not guaranteed to always work. You can find situations in which it will be more difficult, but most of the time, if you take benchmark models and different worlds, it'll work fine. You're only using the total rate, and you're not binning it to look at angular distributions. Eventually, you'll want to look at angular distributions and do it right, but you're not binning it, so it should work quite early. Now, in fact, most of the paper we wrote is spent on the possibility of subtle things happening which make it more difficult. We know that you often see mainly mass differences from decay chains, and it could happen that that the mass measurement you make is more sensitive to mass differences than to masses under some circumstances, and that you could then have a heavier thing faking the lower cross-section of a gluino, say, if it was a spin one heavier thing. But then you can break those degeneracies by finding observables sensitive to the relative strengths of two or three different channels and measuring those. So we go into some detail in the paper for 10 pages on how to break the degeneracies if they should occur, so that you can indeed do this. But the basic point is that at the level of 100 inverse picobarns or a few times that, depending how big the signal is and whether there are complications, you can make early measurements that will indeed test the idea that you're finding a certain kind of result and not others. And eventually you can make it more and more precise and check other quantum numbers, including gauge couplings. We're currently taking some of the benchmark models and actually going through the process, simulating the data, then measuring the input spins in those in order to show that that in fact it works in those. And here we can't really estimate how much luminosity is needed. We can just guess from numbers of events, but here we'll be able to actually, hopefully in a matter of weeks, but of course it's probably a little longer, come up with precise luminosity measurements that work in different cases. So that's a second subject. Next, I want to turn to an issue like Eugenol mass unification. That's one of the basic questions we would like to understand. That there's a high scale, say, and we would like to know if the masses are unified at that high scale. It's a very important test of theory. At a hadron collider, it's unlikely we can measure the Eugenol masses. Even if we can measure some of the superpartner masses that they're involved with, we have to invert to get M1 and M2, say, and we have to run them up and so forth. But the key point for this and for some of what I've already said and for what comes later is that the signatures at the LHC, and I'll be more precise about what I mean by signatures in a few minutes. Signatures, though, are things that experimenters definitely measure. They're not masses of superpartners or tangent beta or something you have to extract. They're measurable things that will be reported by experimenters early and later. Signatures are sensitive. So signatures are things like the number of events with opposite sign, same flavor, dileptons plus two or more jets plus some amount of Michigan energy. That's a signature. And we don't ask whether it came from a particular thing. Signatures are sensitive to whether the high-scale Eugenol masses are unified or not. If they're unified, you get certain kinds of results coming out in the data later. If they're not unified, you get different kinds of results coming. And so this gives you a way to look. So we did a study. We want to study this. We started with a very simple case. We take high-scale models that are in the class called mirage mediation. If you don't know what that is, it doesn't really matter. It's a one-parameter situation where the tree-level gay genome masses are unified, but they're the same order as the anomaly mediation contribution gay genome masses. And again, it doesn't really matter if you know what those are. They interfere. And so the masses are not the same at the high scale, but there's a single parameter that measures how different they are. And if that parameter is zero, then they're unified. And if it's different from zero, they're not. And here's a summary of the results in one situation. So here's the parameter alpha. These are my co-authors on this paper, which is being written now. Here is the minimum luminosity you need to measure alpha at a certain amount. So you can see that, so this is one inverse femtobarn, 100 inverse picobarns. You can see that if alpha is bigger than about a half, then you need very little data to see the effects of gay genome mass unification. If there's, the numbers are still all of order one, but it's separated nicely. And then it starts to get worse. But at 50 inverse femtobarns, you can go down to alpha of about 0.03 or something, 0.05, and see effects in the data, in the signatures, with that much data. And so we're now studying this in several situations. We're extending it to more complicated models. And we'll in the paper, we'll have a list of the signatures that actually let this happen and explain it in some considerable detail. But the key point is that you can, at a hadron collider, things are sensitive enough so that you can see the effects of gay genome mass non-unification, at least in simple situations like this. And we'll see how well one can do in more complicated ones. Now I want to turn into focusing on, for the remaining time, really aiming at getting underlying theories out, getting insight into underlying theories. Most work has on learning about underlying theories has been of the form where you calculate something and you hope that when there's data, you'll recognize it, and then you've got it. I want to try and work on a kind of more systematic approach, saying that one can focus in on classes of underlying theories. I'm going to focus on string theories, but you'll see that one can do it more generally. An important thing to keep in mind is that when people talk about low-scale supersymmetry and effective theories, then we have the 105 parameter disease. But those are low-scale theories that may come from high-scale theories that only have a few parameters in general. Issues like the degeneracy that we found earlier can be thought of that way. If you have an underlying theory that where the parameters that affect low-scale information are smaller, and you can calculate all 105 parameters, or however many there are when you include neutrino masses and whatever, in terms of the underlying theory parameters. And at colliders, there are somewhere in the range of about 7 to 20 that are important for describing what happens. So many of the degeneracies are eliminated because you can express them in terms of the high-scale theory. Of course, we don't know the underlying theory yet, so that might decrease your confidence in doing this effectively. But again, the signatures, and I'll start listing signatures in a minute so you get a better sense of what those are, definitely depend on those parameters. And so the patterns of signatures, it's several signatures and their patterns that reflect the parameters, and you can make progress with understanding things. Now, obviously, you can do this in any kind of theory. I want to do it in string theory because I like string theories, and that's because they address all the issues and questions that we want answers to. It's progressed to the point where you can do some reliable calculations in some cases. I'll say a little more about that in a minute, and you can compare some cases. So there's actually two themes in what I'm going through now, and please don't confuse them. I am talking about a kind of general approach to underlying theories and data, which would work perfectly well for other kinds of theories. But I'm also talking on doing this with string-motivated theories. because for me that's the most exciting possibility. I'm not trying to make stronger claims. I've learned that I should say this from in talks before I'm jumped on about string theories than what's justified. There are no full constructions yet of string theories. We're making models that look reasonable from the view of what is known, and all the assumptions that go in are plausible. Another thing I've learned to mention, which surprised me at first, I want as few generic predictions of string theories as possible. If a prediction is generic, it means you can't learn from it. So I want all sorts of predictions that depend in detail on what's going on the compactification and how supersymmetry is broken and mediated and lots of things. Then from the data, I can learn about the high scale theory. Something that was kind of surprising to us as we went through examples is that we actually find that there are a number of unavoidable low-scale predictions from string theories once you start out with a high-scale structure, sometimes surprising ones. They are sometimes generic. You can learn still from what causes them, but not so much in detail. Now let me turn to the practical thing of the signatures. Experimenters actually report things like the numbers of events with missing ET above something and some number of jets and so forth. Numbers of lepton pairs. I'll show you some concrete examples in a minute. But that's all we really get. There's going to be talks and papers which have these counting things, and then some distributions and histograms, and we can use those too in this analysis. And from those, we're supposed to figure out what the new physics is, and that's obviously very difficult to do. Our criteria for a semi-realistic string-motivated vacuum for the examples we want to consider is that we can write down a model in which there's n equal 1 supersymmetry and the moduli are stabilized in a de Sitter vacuum, which is usually metastable. And there's a stable hierarchy between the electroweak scale and the string scale that you can connect perturbatively, and a visible sector that accommodates the particle content of the MSSM. We would like to have better embeddings, which even have sometimes what are usually called exotic particles that are part of the embeddings, but there are not yet concrete examples with correct string theory and using the right metrics for the manifolds and so forth that do that. You have to have in these approaches for us to do it a mechanism for breaking the electroweak symmetry and not violate any experimental constraints and at least accommodate cage coupling unification. So the models that we have today are frameworks that are close to this in most cases. So we proceed by picking a corner of some string theory like these and compactifying by some method like compactifying M-theory directly on a seven-dimensional manifold with G2 holonomy or whatever you like, and stabilizing moduli in those cases and generating the electroweak Planck symmetry. And we can do that in various examples, which I'll show you some of in a minute. Then you write down the superpotential and the gauge kinetic function in the case of potential. You do supergravity calculations. You take existing programs, if you can, which you can for the MSSM cases, and run down. You impose all the constraints from data and the electroweak symmetry breaking. You generate events and hadronize and do some combining into jets, and you get some stuff. The software, you know, exists for every part of this now, and as a result of many people's great work over the last 2 or 3 years, it's mostly user-friendly, and lots of things are there that you can do this stuff with that are really nice. Then you don't know the high-scale parameters, so you vary the high-scale parameters, the microscopic ones, over their entire allowed region. They're in different theories. They might be modular weights or other kinds of things, and what you get from that is what we call a footprint in this signature space. And then ideally you repeat that with a different form of supersymmetry breaking or a different compactification and you get different footprints, I'll show you. And one of the main results is that the footprints don't fill the entire space. They really are representative. You can understand exactly where they come from. There are many signatures you can use. You can split up jets and leptons into categories. Even early, you can use Bs and Taus and things like that for relative things, even if they're harder to know your efficiencies and so forth. So you can imagine signature spaces where you plot one signature and another, and two different footprints are there. The data might be overlapping both, or it might overlap neither, or they might not even overlap. But you can find all sorts of situations. The four examples I'll show you are two KKLT type ones where the supersymmetry breaking and making it realistic was done by Choi and collaborators. The large volume example of Quevedo and collaborators, where they've written several papers making realistic predictions, and our M-theory compactification on a G2 manifold that we've done, where we've made it realistic. We've done ourselves all the calculations in a consistent way for all of these, so that we know that they're treated in the same way and that it all can fit together. The standard model backgrounds are generally not an issue for this, and we've, at this stage, of course, when you have real data and you really want to distinguish things, you'll take this more seriously and look at it more in detail. But we're treating it just by sort of looking, making a region of the plots, which we can't go into because we know we'll be in the standard model. I'll just show you a few graphs now, and all those event rates are 4-5 inverse Empto-Barnes. So I'll show you four of these kinds of graphs. Here's one signature, same sign, different flavor, dileptons plus jets plus missing transverse energy. Opposite sign, same flavor, dileptons. The four models are the four colors. You can see that there's overlaps. We don't know from limited statistics if something like this is one large footprint where we didn't manage to populate this, or we're in different regions of parameter space, but that's just a computation issue that can be easily solved with a little more work. So here's some more. I'm going to show you altogether four of these, trileptons and same sign dileptons. Here's events with two or more B-jets and same sign dileptons, always with missing transverse energy and some jets. And the last one is one B-jet versus three or more B-jets, just to give you a sense of what these are like. We've learned that we can always figure out why the graphs are the way they are, and by looking at various features, and I don't have time to go into that. One of the most important points, though, is that the overlaps on one signature plot, since we have a real theory, we can look at the overlap region, and then we can look at it on a second plot, and they're different. So we found that by looking at six or seven signature plots, we can always separate the overlaps for any of these theories. And one has literally dozens of plots by taking, well, if you take 10 signatures, you can make a lot of useful plots from that. You can, in addition, take any kind of PT distribution and bin it and make plots, or look at forward-backward asymmetries and make plots. All of that can be used. But the main point I'm making here is that we really can separate the overlap regions because we have a theory. Some of the advantages of doing this kind of approach to interpreting the data, one is that you're really looking at real signatures, not at the hoped for interpretation in terms of masses or tangent beta or something. There's no swampland issue because we're using theories. It certainly reduces the degeneracy problems perhaps quite a bit. In practice, some of these have a full cosmology, so we can include inflation parameters, dark matter relic densities, and scattering amplitudes as real signatures for that model if we want to distinguish it. Once we get several models that fit the data, that describe the data with many signatures, that'll be important to do. We can include things like flavor physics and CP physics as well. We don't have to leave anything out. And it's not trivial that one actually learns a lot about string theory by trying to do this. Obviously, it would be much better if lots and lots of people would study these things and improve what we're doing, which is surely possible. So, a couple concluding slides. This is basically a new approach to trying to understand how to get an underlying short distance theory from data and study underlying theories. Maybe no example will be consistent with the signature plots because we haven't found the right kind of approach, and that would be pretty instructive. Maybe several examples will be consistent, and then it'll be a great challenge if we can find 10 signatures and make a lot of plots and a few examples really describe those, that'll be incredibly exciting because they'll be favoring certain kinds of high-scale theories and a great challenge to separate those. And maybe after a while there'll be one sort of class. So finally, the LHC data will depend on the hidden sector and the compactification and the gauge genome mass unification and lots of such things. It won't be sensitive to only, no signature will be sensitive to only one feature of those things. If you try and isolate one, you'll fail, or you'll probably fail. But by looking at a number of signature plots and the patterns, you might succeed. Different classes of realistic frameworks do give limited and generally different footprints. They can definitely be distinguished, and it'll be remarkable and wonderful if any underlying theory is consistent with the data on the signature plots that get reported next year. Thank you.
So in these string constructions that you showed, these were gravity mediation in every case?
The constructions we looked at were all gravity mediation. Yes, that's all we've done so far.
So I understand why flavor is safe in large volume, but can you say some things about why flavor is safe in the G2 and the KKLT?
In the G2 case, it's safe for two reasons. One is that the scalar masses are all predicted to be large. They're basically the M3 hat, the gravitino mass is of order tens of TeV, and the scalars are degenerate with the gravitinos. In addition, they're degenerate up to Kähler potential effects that should be small that we can't really calculate. But the combination makes them fine and safe.
Okay. And the KKLT, this was like a mirage mediation scenario? Or?
One of them, one KKLT one is where the supersymmetry is broken with the anti-D3 brain that was put in, and the other is with an F-term added. We've spelled it out in the papers again. I didn't have time to go into any detail about that, but they're just taken from the literature, and we did recalculate them.
I had a question about the idea of determining gluina spins through production cross-section measurement. So what the experiments actually measure, of course, is the rates, right? And those are proportional to production cross-section, but they also depend on the decay chains, both through branching ratios and through cut efficiencies, right? And the question is, given the freedom for different decay chains of the gluina that you have in the MSSM, did you try to understand how much that can affect or hurt you trying to measure the production cross?
The question is covered by my saying that you found a signal in one channel that's a few picobarns and big enough. So then you can do that analysis there. But it's certainly true that if there are other decay modes that we're not seeing of that same thing, that it's something we have to worry about, yes. But if you're seeing a few picobarn signal in one channel and you're finding a consistent spin analysis, chances are good that it makes sense, but you're right that it has to be checked. I agree, and we talk about worries like that a little bit in the paper, and we'll do them very well for the benchmarks. From the plots. Yeah, I sort of skipped over it, but I had one slide saying you can tell why they're in some region and not another and so forth. And so in the paper we have a couple sections which look at qualitative lessons from the kinds of things you can get. We have not yet tried to invert it very much in an analysis and go backwards to important qualitative things, but we show how you can do that for a couple examples in the paper. And so, I have a list of the kinds of things that you can see. So one or more of these will always sort of tell you why the footprints have the size and shape they do and why some overlap and some don't. So we were able to interpret them in terms of just these kinds of qualitative features you would want and see how it worked. But I have mixed feelings about how I say it, because I want it to be possible to do the analysis without first knowing that, and to do it for theories where it might be too complicated to see it easily. Sometimes three or four features are combining. On the other hand, as you say, it's really important to be able to do that finally when you've got data. Well, no, you have all this. I don't think it's true that things are sensitive to one feature and that you're going to be able to isolate it. Sure. And then you can see the kinds of things that give it, yes. And so the method will let you do that in detail. But we didn't try and do it yet because we were focusing on the other side of it so far.
Okay, is there any other question? Okay, so then we thank Gordy for resume at 4 in Broidehall, right? Yeah.